This morning, it's a pleasure to welcome back Dr. Sean Baca, who's given us many lectures on rheumatology topics. Dr. Baca currently is a practicing rheumatology with Rheumatology Associates here. He did his medical school at the University of New Mexico and then did his internship at the Mount Sinai Medical Center in Miami Beach, his residency there, and also did his fellowship in rheumatology at the University of Miami School of Medicine. This morning he's going to give us a talk on osteoporosis, diagnosis, treatment, and controversies.
Thank you for coming. So I don't really have any disclosures other than the Russians had nothing to do with writing this report. Now, as far as the objectives, we're going to define osteoporosis as risk factors, we can discuss treatment and prevention, and we're going to talk about some controversies, difficulties. We'll try to leave some time at the end for Q&A because I think that's probably the most interesting part of this. Okay, so what's the definition of osteoporosis? Basically, it's defined as a compromised bone strength. And so strength really is a product of bone density and bone quality. So bone density is easy to measure, right? We have a bone density machine, you look at the amount of calcium in bone, et cetera. But the problem is that's a surrogate marker for really bone strength, and realize that, you know, bone densities have their issues because of that. And as far as bone quality, they're much more difficult to assess because you're looking at microarchitecture. You have techniques like micro-CT bone biopsies, but things that are not practical in the clinics. So again, we're using the bone density as our surrogate marker. So what are the societal impacts of osteoporosis? Right now, we're estimating about 10 million people have osteoporosis and 34 million people have osteopenia. Remember, osteopenic patients break too, okay? So one out of three Caucasian women have a fracture during a lifetime, and one out of five males. Now, when you think about it, one out of three is huge. I mean, one out of three people don't have a heart attack, breast cancer, et cetera, et cetera. This is past an epidemic, and this is a very treatable disease that's not being treated adequately. So what happens? Typically, what we call a sentinel event is usually something such as a vertebral or a wrist fracture, and often these will precede the hip fracture by approximately 10 years. So if a person's had a vertebral fracture, then the risk of having a hip fracture goes way up, and that'll be identified in your fracture risk tools. But again, you know, these are sentinel events, so when somebody breaks their wrist in their late 40s or 50s, this is a reason for screening. So the annual incidence is approximately 2 million fractures per year, about a quarter are vertebral, and about a quarter are hip and pelvic, and the rest are wrist and non-hip fractures. As far as the cost, you're looking at about 400,000 hospital admissions at this time. These numbers are going up because this is actually from 2007. About 2.5 million office visits, about 180,000 nursing home admissions, and the total cost in 2005 was at $17 billion, and now it's probably getting close to $25 billion, okay? Hip fractures result in mortality, and this is important. So the average, they're estimated up to 20% in people that are over 50. And 20% of people who do fracture develop long-term problems, and they often end up living in nursing homes. So only 40% of people who fracture a hip end up unscathed at the end of a couple years. Now, mortality is increasing also with vertebral fractures, and also you see a higher mortality for a hip fracture than you do with breast cancer. So if you look at the odds ratio, it's almost double. And this is what we have to emphasize to people, because patients come in and they don't want to take even simple medications, and you discuss with them cancer. And say, well, you had breast cancer. You say, doc, give me the chemo, give me the radiation, blah, blah, blah. And they would have no problem in doing it. But if they've had a hip fracture, say, I want to give you a pill of Fosamax, you think you're trying to kill them. You know, so we're very irrational how we deal with this. So in terms of vertebral fractures, they cause also chronic complications. Dr. Fernie will tell you this. You see people who start developing spinal stenosis, they get more arthritis. You can get restrictive lung disease, abdominal pain, you know, increased satiety. And also, the need for more chronic services. And of course, if you break a shoulder or hip or wrist, you know, a certain proportion of those people develop AVN or osteoarthritis as a result, which will result in another surgery down the road. So we are losing the battle. the fracture rates and the death rates due to osteoporosis is going back up. We were showing a very substantial improvement in the past with the introduction of alendronate, and basically now we are losing the battle. Patients have an incorrect perception of the risks of taking these medications, and of course there's also very poor reimbursement for treating these diseases. Reimbursement for DEXA is down to $39, which is less than the cost of the machine. We do thousands of bone densities in our office, and I can tell you we barely break even or lose a tiny bit of money every year, and that's with doing thousands of scans per year. So we've lost over 5,000 bone density centers in the United States over the last few years because of this policy. So osteoporosis-related fractures. So in the orange bar, you see osteoporotic-related fractures. I want you to look over at the pink bar or the purple bar. That's the number of patients who are diagnosed with breast cancer per year. So if I just told you that a certain proportion between, 20% or so of this fraction dies, okay, and not everybody gets breast cancer dies, right? In fact, we have very good, mortality data now in the United States. You can see that the death rate from this disease dwarfs this disease. In fact, people will tell you, you can add these together, okay, in terms of the mortality, and you will still have the same or higher mortality for osteoporosis. So what are the risk factors? Personal history of fracture as an adult, history of fracture of a first-degree relative. It's always important to ask about parents and brothers and sisters. Low body weight, smokers, drinkers, people who are on steroids, and, of course, things that increase the risk of frailty, such as impaired vision, premature menopause, whether surgical or natural, and also, of course, low physical activity and low calcium intake. Secondary causes, we're not going to go into this in detail, but I promise you all these things are seen, and I've seen every single one of them, including mastocytosis. These things all can present with progressive bone loss. If you see somebody who's not responding to the therapy, they always should be looked at a second time for any kinds of second causes. Now, medications are a big one that cause issues. I'm going to put a question mark next to proton pump inhibitors, because there's some controversy with that. We felt that there probably was associated with it. I will tell you that what I normally do is I just make sure that patients take calcium citrate rather than carbonate, because that tends to absorb better with the proton pump inhibitors. But, the data's back and forth. Some people are claiming it's not as bad as it is, but right now it's still on the list. Coumadin also, not just heparin. And, of course, anything that involves manipulating hormones, such as using aromatase inhibitors, and also when we're treating male patients for prostate cancer, we also get ourselves in trouble. And, of course, the biggie is steroids and excessive thyroid medication. So steroids in particular, I want you to see this, is that this is a risk of hip and vertebral fracture. And you can see it, even at 2.5 milligrams per day of prednisone, your risk of fracture goes up. Okay, so prophylactically, patients on steroids should be on something. Okay. And at least have a baseline workup. So usually my routine is if I get somebody who has PMR or tempororitis or, some illness that I know they're going to be on steroids for long periods of time, I will put them on alendronate, even when they're osteopenic. Okay, as far as DEXA testing, one thing, remember, it's DXA, not DEXA, okay? Any females over 65 and males over 70 by NOF guidelines. But you'll start at 50 if anybody has risk fractures. One of them, of course, is any kind of fracture after 50, okay, so male or female. Measurement of BMD, I think you all know this. And basically, this is a T-score. So a T-score basically is a standard deviation from the mean, okay? So when you're 2.5 standard deviations from the mean, makes you basically in the bottom 5 percentile, okay? So when patients say, do I have mild osteoporosis? The answer is no. There's nothing as mild about being in the bottom 5 percentile. So, they like these terms. And unfortunately, you see that when some radiology reports. Fortunately, our hospital doesn't do that, but I've seen ones that say you have mild osteoporosis. Remember that osteopenic patients also will fracture. So osteopenia is not a pass in not treating. So T-scores compare you to an individual healthy young person, and it's basically measured to describe an individual's diagnosis. So what is your T-score? Now, I'm going to warn you a little bit. If you're looking at T-scores in male patients, recently the NOF changed the diagnosis, the definition a little bit. And in the past, we used to have separate T-scores measuring male patients against other males. And recently, they changed the convention to say that we're just going to measure against the same database, i.e. females. So if you see a male T-score dropping and they're on therapy in the last couple of years, look at the actual BMD numbers and see if that's changing or not, because they may actually not be changing because the calculation is, the way it's been done is calculated differently in the machines right now. Now, a Z-score, that's interesting. That compares you to your age group. So let's say you have a Z-score of a 75 or 80-year-old. That's not the same thing as a T-score. So this would be similar to looking at a growth curve on a child. If your Z-score is low, it means you're even below your age population. So that means if you're low for an 80-year-old and you're 80, you may have a metabolic disease, and you probably need to also look for secondary causes of bone loss. It's why they're much lower than your own population. So diagnosis basically shows osteopenia, i.e. 2.5 standard deviations from the mean at any site. That's it. Okay, you don't need to have 1, 2, 3, and 4. Any one counts. Okay, a chain is only as strong as its weakest link, right? Now, if a patient has a fragility fracture and they have an osteopenic DEXA, they still have osteoporosis, and that should still be their diagnosis. So if somebody comes in with a hip fracture and they had a minus 1.8 T-score and they're 70 years old, they have osteoporosis, period. Vertebral fracture, same thing, period. Unless they fall off a building at 40 and they've got a wonderful bone density, they probably, you know, are looking at somebody who has osteoporosis. Now, a few pearls, hip densities. Now, the femoral neck is the most predictive of fracture, okay? You do not look at the Ward's triangle, okay? That was an experimental thing. It's still in the reports, but basically that's not used for diagnostic purposes. The total hip bone density should be used to compare different scans between the years. So you don't use femoral neck to femoral neck. You go total to total. And the reason for this is because you're looking at three different points, so technically it's a little bit more stable. So you do not compare femoral neck to femoral neck from the previous scan. You do total to total. Okay? When you're looking at lumbar spine, you have falsely higher results because of scoliosis, osteoarthritis, large spurs, previous fractures, so you have to eliminate those vertebral bodies if you're looking at them. What you can do a lot of times if you get all the pictures, you'll see an algorithm in the back on lumbar spine that'll have L1, L4, but also have each individual vertebral body, and then it'll have combos of two vertebral bodies. And you can use that to make a determination. Let's say the person had a fractured L1, but L2 is minus 2.8, 3 is 2.7. Then you basically can still call it osteoporosis on that, even if L1 and L4 is 1.9 or something. Okay, because again, spurring can alter your results. Okay, but just make sure that if you're comparing the lumbar spine from the previous year, that you're doing the same way. Okay, follow-up scans generally every 2 years. I don't usually use them more often than that. There might be some certain circumstances you might be more concerned. Somebody you're not really sure about, they're on steroids and, you know, they have a great density. Maybe you'll do it at a year to see if they're dropped. But for the most part, don't order it unless it's going to change your therapy, and 2 years is good enough. As far as comparing scans, you cannot compare scans from different manufacturers. This is a problem in how this is done. You basically have three different machines. You've got Norlands, you've got Lunars, and you've got Hologic's, and each one calculates your T-scores differently. And therefore, if you look at a T-score from machine A and machine B, you're going to get different results. And the same thing even with the raw BMD numbers. Technically, you want to use the same manufacturer, and the best thing to do is always do on the same machine when possible. Whenever colleagues send me patients, I always insist that they go back to the original machine to go ahead and get the follow-up scans. Part of the problem, too, is that even if you have identical technology, the way the calibrators are set is each calibration and each calibrator is unique for each machine, and you actually have more drift between machines, even if they're the same technology, unless you actually physically take that calibrator and drive it to each machine and actually calibrate using that one. So that's not practical. So again, same machine. So as far as treatment guidelines, if they've had a previous hip or vertebral fracture, basically, they need to be treated. Okay, now, quiz. How often are vertebral fractures symptomatic? I mean, how often do people get back pain from vertebral fractures? Give me a number. One out of three. So it means that two-thirds of the time when people break their back, they never knew that they even broke it. Okay? This is a problem because when you do chest x-rays, often the radiologist will not mention the fact that the person had a thoracic fracture because they're looking for tumors or infiltrates or other things, but they're there. So when you ever have an opportunity to look at x-rays, do so. But if you have a fracture, that person has osteoporosis regardless of their bone density again, and they should be worked up. Okay? And again, you don't have to have symptoms for vertebral fractures. Basically, about T-score minus 2.5 or below, femoral, neck, total, hip, or spine, you treat. Wrist, I noticed I didn't put the wrist in there. Okay, wrist is a surrogate marker. Wrist numbers tend to run lower than the other vertebral bodies. And if you talk to Dr. McClung, who helped set some of this stuff up, a lot of the databases for wrists are actually very small. And in the old days, those of us like Dr. Forstar members, you know, used to have the old collimator and you'd pull a little thing and run out of the room real quick and you'd throw a little radiation on the wrist and then you come back. That was the, how we used to do the test. So it's kind of a surrogate from the, for the old days. But if a person's had basically back surgery and they've had hip surgery, then that may be the best that you can look at. So for following it might be helpful, but it's more difficult in terms of diagnoses. You're going to treat postmenopausal females or males who are osteopenic who have a positive Frax analysis. So how many people have looked at the Frax tool? Residents, do you know what that is? Yes? Comes on your report. Okay, so what the Frax is designed to determine which patients with osteopenia should be treated with medication. Okay, this is an algorithm, which means like all algorithms, a bunch of old guys got in a room and decided this is how you're going to do it. Right or wrong, you know, this is what we do. So there are always going to be some things that you're going to have to, you know, adjust in, with your own mind in terms of if a person should be treated or not. But this is a good guide to help you decide whether or not you want to treat your patients or not. So essentially you treat if the 10-year risk of fracture is greater than 20% for any fracture and greater than 3% for hip fractures. So they give you two different numbers. And so this is what it looks like. And basically you plug in all the numbers. The newest algorithm is even more friendly. What they actually do is they'll convert the weight and height into metrics for you, and then basically they'll come out and they'll throw a number. So this person's at 18 and 1.8, so technically according to Frax, they don't need to be treated as of yet. But this takes into account things like parental fractures, if the person's had a fracture, and certain risk factors, including rheumatoid arthritis, which is considered a large risk factor for fracture, and I'll spit out these numbers. So evaluation of low bone densities, okay? So first of all, the most important tool that you have is your brain, right? So you ask about history. You want to know about the medications. Are you taking any that are associated with bone loss? Did they have premature menopause? Did they have cancer treatment? Did they have radiation medications? A lot of chemo agents are really pretty bad for the bone density. As far as parental history, family history, fractures, also osteoporosis in the family, if the patient's had a personal history of hypercalcemia or kidney stones, the patient's fracture history, and the patient's fall history. You want to discuss lifestyle issues, how much they're smoking and drinking, do they exercise, what's their diet like, and again, physical environment. You know, they have a lot of slippy rugs in the house, do they have grab bars in the shower, you know, are they have personal protective equipment to prevent them from falling, okay? Physical, you look at the amount of height loss they have, you examine them for kyphosis, and look at balance and strength. So what do we do to evaluate osteoporosis? This is pretty much what I do, and every patient is sent to me at his initial baseline. I think it's important to get a PTH. The problem with looking at just calcium and vitamin D is you could have a normal calcium, but your PTH could be out of whack and your vitamin D's low because the body is trying to balance itself, and so you want to see where they are. So these are all important. I do a fair amount of SPEPs, as Dr. Sohani will tell you, because she gets a lot of these patients that have MGUS, but basically every once in a while we pick up something crazy. Thyroid profile, cortisol levels. If they've had one recently, that's fine. If you suspect any kind of adrenal issues, get a cortisol level. And as far as looking at bone markers, you've got bone markers for anabolism and also catabolism. And basically those are also sometimes helpful, especially if somebody's been on therapy for a while and you're trying to determine what you're going to give them next. For example, somebody's been on bisphosphonate for long periods of time and they're coming in and you're thinking, do I need drug A or drug B? These might be helpful in that scenario because it might help you decide if you need an anabolic agent or not. Okay, and as far as calcium, phosphorus, and creatinine, also always important because you want to know if a patient has any renal bone disease. So imaging, besides your bone density, it's a good idea to do a lateral x-ray. Okay, you want to see if they've had any previous fractures. DEXAs can actually do morphometry, another thing that's not reimbursed, but basically what it is it gives you a percentage score and it compares year to year and it'll tell you whether or not there's been a change, because if you see a change, then obviously looks like you're developing a crush fracture. That's important because, say, the bone density has gone up in L1, but the L1 volume has dropped, then obviously then you're not winning and that's not a real number. So, and again, fracture on x-ray plus osteopenia equals osteoporosis, so you put osteoporosis on your chart. And once you're osteoporotic, you're always osteoporotic. Now, males, hormone therapy for prostate cancer causes rapid bone loss. So again, I think anybody in androgen deprivation therapy should probably be considered to have a alendronate. At least they should have a baseline bone density. You can consider testing for testosterone deficiency in males. Of course, a lot of males are not eligible for getting therapy because of other medical problems, but it can at least help you determine one of the reasons why they lost bone mass. And NOF recommends all males over 70 should have a bone density test. And the problem with that is Medicare won't pay for all males over 70 unless the test is positive, but you can't do the test and it's positive unless you do the test. So that's our problem. But again, it's not an expensive test anymore. It's $39. So you know what? They'll pay more than that doing going out to dinner. So, you know, I would encourage them to do it at least once. So prevention and treatment options. Okay, so the first thing is always a non-pharmacologic therapy, so that things such as grab bars, assistive devices, walkers, etc. Weight-bearing exercise is good, and resistance exercises is better. Weight-bearing could include things like squats, walking, etc. There's now some data that shows that you're probably not going to get as much benefit by going to the pool than you would necessarily taking a long walk, taking squats, et cetera, but you have to modify these things for your patient because obviously some patients can't do some of those things. They've got bad stenosis, so you do what you can do, but keep them moving. Balance and posture exercises, maintaining a strong core, trying to avoid sedative medications such as giving your patients Ambien at night, you know, so that they fall in the middle of the night when they're going up to pee, and of course, a lifestyle modification in terms of alcohol, tobacco, et cetera. So calcium recommendations, 1,000 if you're premenopausal and 1,200 if you're postmenopausal. And for males, it's basically age 70, 1,000 or younger, and then older, 1,200 milligrams. So how do you estimate the calcium intake? You have this slide here. This is probably a good thing to have for you at the clinic, but just realize that it's 300 milligrams for every dairy product or dairy substitute. Like if you have almond milk, soy milk, et cetera, they usually put in the equivalent of this. And then you take only 100 for dark green vegetables. So your vegetarian who tells them, I eat plenty of vegetables, you technically have to have 12 dark green vegetables in a day in order to get enough calcium, so it's not going to happen. So they need basically some supplements to their diet. You add all up, add 250 for insensible loss, and that should give you an estimate of your total calcium intake. So for most people, one or two supplements and a little bit of dairy in their diet usually will get them there. So how much vitamin D do I give? I hear this all the time. Well, the answer is very simple. Basically, you take enough that keeps your numbers between 30 and 60 is fine. But in terms of vitamin D, every once in a while you'll see patients whose vitamin D levels drift. And there may be a reason for that. And that basically is that the capsule forms actually degrade quickly and they're not as stable. So you're better off if you're doing an over-the-counter vitamin D to make sure your patients actually get the tablets and not the capsules. Okay? So that's an important pearl. If the vitamin D levels remain low despite everything you're doing, think about celiac disease, okay, and screen them for that. Prevention. Non-pharmacologic intervention we talked about, okay? And then we also have serums, oral bisphosphonates, and estrogen. Now realize that estrogen is not approved for treatment of osteoporosis. It used to be, but it's only now for prevention, okay? Now realize that most women go through this rapid drop after menopause, so I would suggest that, you know, we probably would be best off if we can convince our female patients to take an estrogen or a serum for a period of time post-menopause, especially early menopause, and or even potentially bisphosphonate if you consider their family history high risk. So you can look at the fracture risk tool at menopause and you can decide, but basically the bottom line is that estrogen is not for treatment, only prevention, whereas the serums and the bisphosphonates are for both. Okay? Pharmacologic options, you have anti-resorptive therapy and anabolic therapy. Okay? So you have ones that basically affect the osteoclasts and ones that affect the osteoblasts. So you have, of course, the hormone therapy, calcitonin, which is not used very much, bisphosphonates, and, of course, you have denosumab, which is a biologic. And then as far as anabolic therapy, again, you have basically the PTH analogs. Now, we said that the serums and HRT are anti-resorptive. They decrease bone turnover, and they reduce the risk of vertebral fractures by about 34%, maybe 50% in raloxifene, but they do not reduce non-vertebral fractures. In other words, these drugs are not good for people with bad hips. So if you have somebody who has osteoporosis, especially if their hips are worse than their spine, these are not great drugs to be on unless you have no other choices, okay? The serums are approved for both prevention and treatment. Estrogen only for prevention. Okay, calcitonin. We used to use a lot of that in the old days. And basically, you can get it by injection or nasal spray. It has no GERD issues and basically can help with the acute pain of fracture. Sometimes we'll use that, but we use it much less. And it doesn't have renal issues, but the disadvantage is it doesn't help with non-vertebral fractures. But when I grew up, we didn't have anything except etidronate, which is off-label, and we had human calcitonin, and the salmon came out, and this was all we had when I first started.
Bisphosphonates.
Hello.
It might be able to.
So bisphosphonates. Okay, so the advantages of them is basically they're much lower cost. You can get them in oral forms and IV forms, and the dosing is very selective. You can do weekly, monthly, daily, yearly, depending on what you think is good for your patient. But they don't have the side effects of hormone therapy, such as DVTs, hot flashes, or risk of malignancy. The disadvantages, of course, is GI upset, esophagitis. They're not recommended for renal patients with GFRs of less than 30. And as far as the potential risk, it's very low, but it is there. So
yeah,
esophageal malignancies have been reported. And the biggest problem with bisphosphonates is noncompliance. So we have lots of patients who come in, and the first thing they say is, I'm not going to take this stuff. Can anybody hear me? It's very important that we try to convince them why they need to do it. As far as renal patients, one thing that's interesting, if you talk to Paul Miller, who's a nephrologist who does a lot of osteoporosis research, he will tell you that the oral bisphosphonates are not a problem with the kidneys in general, even with people with kidney disease, because you're literally only absorbing 0.5% of the medication at any one time. And so renal toxicity is mostly seen with the IV bisphosphonates, not with the oral forms. So if you have somebody who has some renal disease, these are still reasonable drugs to use as long as they don't actually have renal bone disease, which is not osteoporosis. So, abandronate, that's Boniva, okay, is not proven to reduce the risk of hip fractures. So we don't really use Boniva anymore. You know, we did at the time when we didn't have anything else, but I think its day is kind of passed a little bit. But just be careful to remember that if you have somebody who has osteoporosis of vertebral spine, their hips are okay, that's probably an okay drug. But if they're low in both, it's probably other generic bisphosphonates that are as effective and less expensive. Okay, as far as gastrointestinal issues, there is a delayed release residronate, which can actually take with a meal, okay? And sometimes that alleviates some of these symptoms. And as far as reducing the risk of vertebral fractures, you're getting approximately 50% for oral therapy and maybe 70% for IV zoledronic acid. Remember, the IVs have more potential for side effects. And you don't use these drugs, the oral ones at least, for patients who have Barrett's esophagitis or intolerance. So this shows you a curve of compliance with bisphosphonates, and you can see that what happens is that if you have the best reduction in fractures, if you're 100% compliant with your drug at all times, If you're only 50% compliant with your bisphosphonate, it's like not taking anything at all, okay? And so even at 75%, you lose a lot of the efficacy. So you have to have your patients be 100% perfect all the time if they really want to get benefit from bisphosphonate. And a lot of times when you see people's bone densities not going up, it's because they're not taking their medication. And really the estimate is they have to be at least 90% accurate for them to have really a reasonable effect. So if they take it half the time, you might as well not even bother doing it. So the anti-resorptives, the biologics, we have one now, denosumab. And basically what it does is it inhibits RANK ligand, which basically prevents activation of the osteoclast. So it's very good and effective in reducing vertebral and hip fractures. It's very easy to administer. It's just a sub-Q injection, has no GI or renal issues, and the bone density continues to go up even with prolonged therapy, because that's one of the issues of bisphosphonates is you tend to plateau at about 5 to 10 years. You don't go down with the bisphosphonate, but you plateau, whereas with denosumab, you continue to go up every year, and they have 12-year data to show that now. The disadvantage, of course, is a higher cost, and it cannot be stopped. And this is probably one of the most important things to know today, is that if you stop denosumab within 18 months of stopping it, your fracture risk goes way up. Because what this does is this does not kill the osteoclasts. A bisphosphonate murders those cells. This only puts them to sleep, okay? And they wake up, and they're not happy. So when they wake up, you actually have a very rapid bone loss if you don't keep them on therapy. So you have to have an exit strategy for these patients if you're not going to keep them on Prolia or denosumab. You have to have them on something else. You can't just stop the drug. Because I've had patients come to me and say, my doctor said I only need this for 4 or 5 years. And so that's an incorrect answer, and you actually put them at a high risk for fracture if you stop. Anabolic therapy. More and more interest in these. You have teriparatide, and now you have abaloparatide. And basically, there's analogs of PTH. As you recall, if you have continuous PTH, you actually lose bone density. But if you give little small increments every day, you actually create what we call G-phase switching. And what happens is that the osteoblasts actually turn on, and you actually get more osteoblastic activity. We can actually measure things like P1NP and bone-specific alk-phos and see them going up with these drugs. There is a point where these drugs will start petering out, and the osteoblastic activity will only increase so much and start petering down, but there's what we call the anabolic window, which the best effect is usually within the first year of using the drug. It's usually used for more advanced disease. And what's interesting about abaloparatide, which has a couple amino acid substitutions, that it probably has a larger anabolic window than teriparatide. And it seems to increase the blastic activity a little bit more than the clastic. But both of these drugs increase the clastic activity as well as the blastic activity. Okay, and that's important because some people feel that that might be helpful in cleaning out old bone. And that the bone architecture using these drugs appears more normal than using other drugs. And so if you have somebody who is very low, you know, you might potentially be concerned about some of the clastic activity with these patients as well. So they do have a rapid onset of effect. You can measure bone enzyme changes within a few months and see whether or not it's helpful, but they're very expensive. They're running $2,000 to $3,000 a month now. Okay, limited to 2 years of treatment. Patients do need to self-inject, which, believe it or not, is difficult for some of our patients to get over the idea of it. Of course, that is a big advantage if they have stomach issues, because then they have to worry about that. Now, there is a black box warning of osteosarcoma on the label. Okay, however, there is very little data to back this up. Okay, and I left you some references underneath here. But they've actually experienced fewer cases than expected. What happened? We lost something here. So there are fewer cases than expected. Okay. As far as future therapies, the sclerostin inhibitors, ocatinib is probably dead. They had some issues with it and other side effects, so that probably is not going to come out. There is a drug called romosuzumab, which will probably come out sometime this year or next year, but they had a cardiac signal, and so that's going to be an issue. But what that one is it's a pure... There you go. It's a pure classic inhibitor and does not affect the blastic activity, so essentially it becomes a pure blastic drug. And they're showing remarkable increases in bone density that literally make Forteo look like water. Okay? So they're talking about 1 year of therapy, like a rescue therapy, and then you put them on the other drugs for maintenance. Now, controversies. This is the fun part. Okay. So calcium and cardiovascular risk. Okay. In October of 2016, basically had the Osteoporosis Foundation, the American Society of Preventive Cardiology, release a joint statement saying there's a lack of evidence linking calcium with or without vitamin D to cardiovascular risk in healthy adults. Now, there was a study previous to that, which was not a study, is a retrospective analysis, and you should always be suspicious of those things because you're basically taking other people's numbers and massaging them. They took 120 studies, they eliminated 100 of them, only looked at 20, and they said, we think that there's a trend. Now, this is a New Zealand study, and if you talk to John Belzikian, who's the editor of the journal, I talked to John, he said they weren't even going to publish this data, but they felt that they needed to just so that it's out there. And they show that there was no calcium group, some calcium, medium calcium, and the highest percentile calcium. In between the second highest calcium and placebo, they saw a trend. But guess what? In the highest calcium group and the no calcium group, there was no trend. But they called it anyway. Okay? So they also told you very specifically in the study, it does not apply to anybody who takes vitamin D with their calcium. So that obviously makes it very suspicious because almost everybody takes D with their calcium. So where this comes from, we have no idea. You know, maybe some of these patients had some kind of calcium derangement, hyperparathyroidism, or other things that might cause some calcium release in the tissues. But basically, again, there is no evidence. Okay, so when patients come up with this, this is one of the things that you debunk. And remember, we just went over the fact that people die from osteoporosis in much higher numbers than these other diseases, and we're not treating this. Okay, second thing. Calcium and vitamin D does not reduce fractures. You probably heard this one recently. And so what happened was is that the study looked at a healthy community of dwelling individuals in nursing homes. They never looked at whether or not the patients had osteoporosis. They did not check their baseline BMDs. And they also were only looking at patients for 6 months. So you don't have the power in a study at 6 months to look for fractures. That's one of the biggest issues with fracture studies. And a lot of times some of the newer drugs won't even look at hip fractures because in order to have a certain number of hip fractures, you have to have thousands of patients in a study and it costs you lots of money. So this was basically not a very well done study, but unfortunately it hits the press. Okay? So the NOF responded to this last year and basically said that they found a significant risk reduction for fractures if you take your calcium and vitamin D. The NOF study excluded those who were taking their own supplements and those who had previous fractures. So they also considered adherence to study protocols. And those results strongly suggest that calcium and D reduces the risk of fractures by about 16%. And hip fractures by even maybe 30%. So, duration of therapy and drug holidays. This is also another myth. You do not have to give drug holidays. You have to look at your patient just like everything else. So, as at the recent bone meeting in Santa Fe, and the moniker is when do you start treating hypertension? You know, you gave them, you know, medication for 10 years. Why don't you stop it now? You don't. So you have to look at the patient. It depends on how severe they are. So essentially, what they looked at is that patients who discontinued therapy had a higher non-vertebral fracture rate. And I'm starting to see that in the office where patients were on therapy, and then they stopped for 10 years or 15 years, and they decided to come back in after they had their fracture, and their bone densities now are worse than their bone densities when they stopped treatment. So if you are going to consider a holiday for a bisphosphonate, you probably should only keep them off the drug for a couple years, recheck the bone densities and see where you are. But I've seen people drop their bone densities as soon as 2 years stopping the drug. Because, again, you still can't control for the fact that they like to have their wine and they don't exercise and other stuff. So these drugs are protective. Since there's no extensive evidence to base therapy, it should be individualized, like everything else in medicine, okay? Protocols are great, but you have to look at the individual, okay? So the FDA recommends that you do not stop denosumab. We talked about that before, because you will have an increased fracture rate at 18 months. And if you stop denosumab, you have to consider some kind of exit strategy. And this is also another pearl. And your exit strategy cannot be reclassed. And there's a reason for that, is because when you stop the denosumab, you don't have any idea when the osteoclasts actually wake up. And if you and the zoledronic acid only works when the cells are active. So if you give them that one dose and the cells haven't woken up yet, it doesn't get taken up. So they're actually better off, if possible, to put them on an oral bisphosphonate. So let's say you had somebody in proly, you bring them up to -2, and you want to basically see if you can get them on a less expensive drug, then you're probably better off with the orals or IV abandronate, because you can stop the process, or you're more likely to stop the process than hitting with zoledronic acid and mistime it, okay? Now, if you look at the CTXs and stuff, maybe you could time it a little bit better that way, but look at your numbers, but this is probably not the best way of doing it. And I know a lot of physicians are doing this right now, but that's probably not the best way of doing it. The problem with going to orals is you go back to the first reason why you took the proly in the first place is that they don't like to take the oral medications because they can't. So often, again, you're just stuck on the denosumab. ONJ, okay, this is the actual definition. Okay, you have exposed bone. It's unhealed for 8 weeks, and there's no history of radiation to the craniofacial region. Now, the problem is that everybody seems to think they have ONJ, okay? I actually had the first case that was actually reported in the literature. My lady was one of four cases, and these were reported out of the dental clinic in Nova years ago. She had metastatic cancer to her skull, okay? She was taking IV Iridia, and she was taking it twice the maximum dose, okay? Fortunately, she lived with this metastatic disease a good 10 years due to good, you know, oncologic care, and she did develop some dental issues later on. But if you look at the majority of people that had ONJ, majority of these patients reported in the literature have all been getting the cancer doses of bisphosphonates. And the same thing is true for denosumab, because you can give that monthly when you're treating people for metastatic disease. So they're not the same animal, but they lump them together. So if you take the osteoporotic patients from the suburbs and you separate them out from a cancer patient who's taking larger doses, those numbers, especially for bisphosphonate, drop to somewhere about 1 in 100,000 to 1 in 10,000 at the highest. 1 in 100,000 is close to the risk of getting struck by lightning if you live in Florida. The other thing is no one's ever died of this, okay? So this is a tooth problem. People do die of hip fractures. So it's not a new diagnosis. It was originally described in the 1850s, and it was associated with infections and heavy metals. And the problem is if you get an abscessed tooth because you don't take care of your teeth and you get exposed bone, technically that could count. But obviously, the drugs don't attack the tissue. What they do is they slow bone turnover. One theory I saw that was interesting was is that this may have something to do with evolution, is if you look at animals like sharks and invertebrates, their teeth move around all the time, because when they bite something, they lose a tooth, they grow another tooth. So maybe a certain amount of bone turnover in the mouth is a good idea, and you are slowing it down with these drugs, okay? But at the same time, you know, we're not giving these huge doses. We're not trying to cause, you know, lack of bone turnover. We're just trying to slow down loss of bone turnover. So we can see this chemotherapy and radiation and steroids. Okay, so those increase your risk of getting ONJ. And most of them are seen after a tooth extraction. They're not usually seen spontaneously. So what we normally do with patients that are going to have an extraction or a dental implant is we tell them, let us know when it's going to happen. We'll hold their drug, and then basically after the dentist clears them, we'll restart them. If they've had a dose of Prolia, we like them to wait, you know, 6 months, get their extraction, get healed, and then come back in. I don't think I've seen an issue yet. Jody, have you seen one? No.
No.
Yep. Okay. And also on the dental website, they even tell them not to check CTXs, and they'll come with a letter saying, we want you to check the CTX on our patient. And basically, they're trying to push blame onto you if they have a dental implant that doesn't hold in a 99-year-old, that it's your fault. Again, most of them are the IV bisphosphonates, up to 97% in the German study. And basically, remember, with the oral studies, and if you're looking at alendronate, resedronate, abandronate, they didn't have one on any of the oral studies that were ever reported. And the only one was two reported in Horizon, which was the Zoledronica reclass study, and they had one in the placebo and one in the treated group. And that's the data that you have. Okay, everything else is, again, case reporting. So we said the incidence is very low. Okay. There is no evidence, guidelines, and only expert opinion. So basically, again, you know, you got to keep your dentist at bay. And, you know, most of them are pretty good at working with you, and some just are, you know, they're just difficult. So, again, the best thing for prevention is good oral hygiene. You know, you hold the drug with extractions, implants, and infections, and you don't restart until the bone is completely healed. Okay, but again, you've got to time this. You can't leave them off drug forever. So I would just want to show you the risk of developing, you know, all of these other things. So this is the risk of a vertebral fracture, wrist fracture, and hip fracture. And if you come all the way over here, this is the risk of ONJ, and this is the risk of being murdered. Okay? And you have a much higher 5-time chance of being murdered than you are to get ONJ, okay? And there's a very big difference between this tall peak and that. And no one's ever died of that I know of. And no one wants to take the treatment for this because of this, okay? So, also atrial fibrillation. You heard that a few years ago about bisphosphonates. Well, there should no clear association between bisphosphonate exposure and risk of basically developing serious or non-serious atrial fibrillation. Now, what was the problem? Is they looked at people, and 10 years later, they said, you know, we see more atrial fibrillation. Now, and somebody at the FDA sent out a warning letter and blah, blah, blah. And then they looked at that, and then they realized that, you know what's one of the biggest risk factors for getting atrial fibrillation? Being 10 years older. And so what they realized was they were just looking at a natural phenomenon, and they couldn't see any difference over other, you know, placebo or other things. But basically, you know, they sound the alarm bell, you know, too easily. And basically, you still have patients who say this. And this, again, is from 2008, but I still hear patients saying, I don't want to get atrial fibrillation. Esophageal cancer, they've had 23 cases that have been reported. But remember, these drugs are very ubiquitous, so lots of people are taking these drugs. But they have not concluded that any patients taking oral bisphosphonates have an increased risk of esophageal cancer, okay? So you should probably not give them to patients who have Barrett's esophagus, or esophageal cancer for that matter, but for the most part, they're safe enough to use in this condition. So what are the impediments? Poor reimbursement. They say that the number of patients on osteoporosis treatment may be down to 3% in this country right now. People have legitimate OP, okay? It's between 15 and 3% of people are on treatment, okay? It's ridiculous. Drug reimbursement issues are an issue. When you try to get them the better stuff, you know, they can't get approvals. Noncompliance is a big stuff. And, of course, you have step therapy with a lot of insurance companies that say, well, you need to take this drug first. Well, the problem is let's say you have somebody who has a very bad bone density. I can show you data from Felicia Cosman who shows that you're probably better off starting off with an anabolic agent first, and then you give them denosumab afterwards. But your insurance companies are basically telling you to put it on a bisphosphonate first, which essentially poisons the bone, and then your anabolic therapy doesn't work as well. Or an even worse disaster is giving them denosumab before teriparatide, because believe it or not, remember I told you that denosumab knocks out the osteoclasts and then they wake up angry. Well, the teriparatide also wakes up the osteoclasts and the blasts. So you actually can actually have transient bone loss in this scenario where you go from denosumab to teriparatide. But again, your insurance policies are encouraging to do this. Don't use this guy until they're in bad shape. So you really want to shoot with the bigger gun sometimes first. There are some studies and switching studies which show that if you give these drugs together, which again is not FDA approved, that you've actually showed the biggest increase in bone density, which is very interesting. So these are the bisphosphonate prescribing rates, and guess what? They're getting worse, okay? And we're also looking at an increased number of fractures. Okay, so the fracture rates were dropping steadily in this country, and somewhere around here, we're actually noticing the fracture rates are going back up. So we need to do a better job. And I told you that a quarter of women who've had a hip fracture or less are even on therapy. And so these are people at super high risk. Okay, it should be noted in the chart when they have a fracture that you are going to address their osteoporosis issues. And this will be a quality measure at some point. And basically, if they've had a fracture, there should be at least a discussion. You don't necessarily need to start them in the hospital, you know, but you need to have a plan that you're going to start them on something and do something about it rather than just a fracture, you know, and wait for the next one to happen. And again, fracture rates have increased from 2013, 14, and 15. And, in 16, I haven't seen the data yet. So we've come a long way in therapy. We have a lot of good options. We can reduce fractures, morbidity, and mortality. The death rates are much higher than that of cancer, heart disease, and we're not reaching the majority of patients. So one of the analogies was, and this is Elizabeth Shane, she said, how would you feel if a patient had a heart attack and you didn't load them up with aspirin, beta blockers, and all kinds of statin before they left the hospital? That would be considered malpractice. But you got people who have hip fractures and back fractures, and they don't get any therapy. And you've got 15% of people, maybe 25 even with high-risk fractures, that are getting any therapy at all or addressing in the chart. That's an issue. Okay, we need to do a better job. And we need to educate our patients better. And if they don't want therapy, you better document it. Okay. So as far as things that make it worse, we've talked about this before, but lack of government insurance support is really affecting us. Drug holidays are detrimental for patients sometimes that are, you know, especially ones that are high risk for fracture. Noncompliance is a big issue, okay? And so we need to continually educate our patients, and there's no compelling evidence to suggest that calcium increases the risk of cardiovascular disease. Okay, so questions? Jeff.
Yeah, about this great lecture, I was wondering for patients, say like elderly people, one epidural injection as you get for Medicare guidelines about 3 or 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And given the strategy for treating those people, they really don't want an operation and seems to get the can down low enough that they're functional enough that they can continue to have these epidurals.
Right. As far as epidurals affecting the bone mass, yeah. Probably. I don't think there's any data. I mean, I think that for the most part, unless you're getting daily oral steroids, you're probably not creating a problem. And I think any patient in that scenario should prioritize bone density anyway, so that should be addressed one way or another. But I don't think you're harming them anyway. You know, I think that whatever their baseline is probably their biggest risk. Yeah. Well, realize that bone densities are based on, again, convention. And at the time, they decided they're looking at L1 through L4, okay? But you do have surrogate markers. So, again, I encourage everybody to do a lateral X-ray, thoracic and lumbar, and everybody that has some height loss, because if you have a vertebral compression fracture, and remember, two-thirds of them are asymptomatic, you have your diagnosis. So I think a reasonable, you know, thing to do is just get a lateral X-ray. And you can look for that kind of stuff, but you're absolutely right.
And one other question. How do you treat post-teriparatide treatment for osteoporosis? So they take 2 years of treatment, and then what happens after that?
Well, you have to give them something. So generally, you put them in on something anti-resorptive. And so the most popular things is either bisphosphonate or denosumab. I would say probably most of the ones that I see are probably going denosumab, probably because they've already cycled through these other drugs. But you have to do something or you're going to lose your gains.
So that's not a permanent cure of osteoporosis?
Well, there is no permanent cure. Just like we can't cure hypertension or hyperglycemia, we treat it.
Sorry.
Yep. Anybody else?
Why do we frequently see such differences between the cortical and the medullary bone, between the skin of the spine and the skin of the hip?
Well, think about it this way, and this is what people use the wrist for. So if you're looking at wrist, you're looking predominantly at cortical bone, whereas if you're looking at lumbar spine, you're looking at more medullary bone, and the hip is kind of a mix of 50-50. So if you have somebody who has hyperparathyroidism, for example, they tend to get more cortical bone loss. So looking at the wrists in patients like that would actually make a lot of sense. And that's why the interesting thing about some of these drugs is that you might actually increase medullary bone mass much more than cortical. So sometimes you'll see the spine and the hip go up, but you won't see, for example, the wrist go up as much. And what's very interesting is if you had a patient who had hyperparathyroidism, you send them for surgery, sometimes the risk goes up the most after they have their surgery. Okay. Yep. Well, above 60, probably not. But when you're getting close to the 90s and above, then, of course, you're increasing your risk of hypercalcemia. And remember, if the calcium goes up, then what happens to your PTH is you shut it off. And you need a certain amount of PTH for anabolism. So you want these things in balance. So if the D levels are too low, your PTH goes up too high. And then what you end up doing is mobilizing your CLAS and losing bone mass in order to keep the calcium in your blood. Because remember, the body's more worried about keeping your calcium level in the blood normal, because calcium, sodium, potassium are basically your body's electrical system. And if those electrolytes are off, you don't do so well. And without the calcium, your muscles don't function. So it will do whatever it has to do to keep that calcium level normal. So if you're nutritionally malnourished, it will still keep that calcium at a normal level. And that's why looking at calcium is totally useless except for hypercalcemia, because you could have a normal calcium and have somebody who has, very low vitamin D levels because they're basically having a pseudo-hyperparathyroidism in order to make up for it. Okay, thanks.